You are listening to Everything Environment by Mongabay India. The world has placed large bets on renewable energy to tackle climate change. The technology, solar panels, windmills, electric vehicles, gleam with hope. But the road to creating clean energy technology leaves behind a messy trail.
We know that renewable energy companies and those who invest in them view themselves as the good guys within the climate crisis. But because of that, there has been less focus on what the adverse impacts of renewable energy projects can be.
Cleantech relies heavily on minerals such as copper, lithium, nickel, cobalt, and rare earth elements. And their demand is booming by the day. Lithium, an irreplaceable component of lithium-ion batteries, which are currently at the heart of electric vehicles, is primarily produced in Australia and Chile. 70% of the global cobalt supply, crucial for batteries, comes from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Since critical minerals come from a few countries, the pressures on those regions are high. Unsafe and unsustainable cobalt mining has led to tragic human rights violations and environmental issues. Several other examples are emerging from countries where such mining occurs, many of them less industrialized nations. After mining, other cleantech supply chain stages include materials production, equipment manufacturing and construction, transport operation, and end-of-life handling of the technology. Issues at any of these stages directly affect the world's plan to reduce carbon emissions and build a sustainable future. India does not mine lithium or cobalt, neither does it produce some key minerals required for manufacturing photovoltaic cells, silicon, silver, indium, arsenic, etc. Since countries depend deeply on each other to meet their clean energy requirements, the massive influence of geopolitics is inevitable. A graph by the International Energy Agency displaying the current processing of cobalt, lithium, nickel, copper, and rare earth metals used across clean technologies shows China in the lead. About 60% of global lithium processing, China. A full 100% of natural graphite processing used for battery anodes, China. The country also leads the manufacturing of solar PV cell and modules. The COVID-19 pandemic and the Russia-Ukraine conflict exposed the volatility of the clean tech supply chain when the world witnessed shortages of semiconductors and critical minerals for manufacturing clean technology. All these scenarios put India in a tough spot in the global clean energy race. In this episode of Gigawatt, we hear about the role of countries, investors, and companies in ensuring a sustainable supply chain and why a course correction is urgent. I am Mayank Agarwal, contributing editor at Mongabay India. We are an online publication dedicated to bringing you stories on science and the environment in India. In our special podcast series, Gigawatt, we will explore some of the biggest questions, challenges, and opportunities in India's transition from fossil fuels to clean energy sources.
My name is Jessie, and I'm the Program Manager for Natural Resources at the Business and Human Rights Resource Centre. And we focus on human rights along the renewable energy value chain, with a specific focus on transition mineral mining and renewable energy projects. I think a lot of stakeholders, like civil society and industry, understand that one of the challenges around ensuring that supply chains are clean or are rights respecting is the opacity of these supply chains currently, which is why you see an emphasis at the moment on pushing industry to undertake supply chain mapping. We know that tracing from a mine site through to a technology, whether that be wind and solar or battery technology, is extremely challenging right now. And we often lose that traceability around the smelting and manufacturing stage. I think there's a general understanding that there are human rights problems with extraction, and that those problems have been historic. And some of those are more well known, like cobalt and child labor. But extraction as a whole is impactful. It may be more present in some locations or more well known, but it is not absent anywhere.
A Mongabay article by Claire Asher notes that a deeply researched example of technological critical element mining impacts is in Inner Mongolia, an autonomous region of China. The Bayan-Obo district supplies half the world's rare earth elements. For decades, the Bayan-Obo open-pit iron mine has also extracted niobium, lanthanum, and neodymium for smartphones, electric cars, and wind turbines, with local communities and ecosystems paying a heavy price. Similarly, biodiversity and human health are at stake in Indonesia, one of the world's richest nickel sources for making wind turbines and electric vehicles.
There is a push for a lot of companies who are wanting to implement more robust human rights due diligence that includes steps to identify, mitigate, and address potential abuse. And the introduction of the EU mandatory human rights due diligence regulation.
The European Union site says that the proposal aims to foster sustainable and responsible corporate behavior throughout global value chains. Companies failing to conduct effective due diligence face administrative penalties and civil liability.
I think it's going to go a long way in setting that bar for what that kind of global standard is, particularly as it is a model that is moving away from voluntary compliance. And that's where we have seen supply chain diligence previously being looked at. And so if companies haven't wanted to undertake it or have wanted to undertake it in a light way, those voluntary mechanisms have sort of allowed them to do that. The EU moving towards a model that is mandatory and that does have repercussions for not meeting it, I think is going to be a significant step towards how companies think about their own supply chain due diligence, but also how renewable companies continue to engage with their mining counterparts, because we know that they currently are not being held accountable for some of the abuses that are happening at the mining site, but they also understand that that is going to be an increasing risk to them. And you have seen some civil society already really looking at this traceability and pushing end user companies, particularly at the moment. There's been quite a focus on EV companies like Tesla who have abuses within their supply chain, such as their nickel supply. So this is going to be a growing area of action, I think, in advocacy for civil society. But I also think there is movement on a global level that will translate down to regions and countries around what mandatory due diligence looks like across the supply chain.
In the context of the sustainable supply chain for such minerals, the debate is often between a business case versus a human rights or, you know, impact on the environment. Is there any way to address that?
You know, that debate of business versus human rights is actually pushed more by less scrupulous companies in the fossil fuel industry. The idea that human rights violations are, you know, unpleasant but a necessary part of the energy transition is absolutely false. And if you look to research from organizations like the Resource Center, we in fact know that the less rights respecting a project or a company is, the more likely it is to drive conflict. Now, when you have conflict around a project site, what you have is delays, you have strikes, you have protests, you have investors pulling out, and you have projects that absolutely do not go ahead. They do not make business sense anymore. We've seen this at an operational level with really large copper projects. There's one in Peru that's a very good example called Los Bambas. It is consistently being shut down because of conflict from both the workers and the community side. And we've also seen this in the exploration and licensing process. Most recently, you may have seen reports coming out from Serbia, where Rio Tinto was trying to open a lithium mine and has had strong opposition from the community, which ended up in the government cancelling that project. Last year, the UN's main human rights body voted to recognise the right to a safe, clean, healthy and sustainable environment as a human right. And they've also appointed a special rapporteur to monitor human rights in the context of the climate emergency. Now, that may sound unconnected to supply chains, but that's a significant step for the UN to take when we know that the supply chains for renewable energy technologies are currently, you know, not transparent and have human rights violations both across them and down at the mine site. I think when countries like India are looking to, you know, a new sector that is expanding rapidly, there are already these kind of principles which they can take, develop into a local context that makes sense and use that as a guiding framework for how they sort of think about how to expand their renewable energy sector as well. Because governance is not only about strong regulation, it is about enforcement. So it's great to have strong environmental protections and laws protecting labor rights, but these rights and protections need political will to be enforced. So there's work for, I think, governments to think about how they are holding companies accountable And often there, I think, is pressure on governments to allow companies to behave in a way that perhaps, you know, it goes against some of local laws to continue the investment within the country and to continue the project within the country. And I do think that there is an increasing shift, not just from companies being held accountable for their overseas projects, but also governments just having, and communities absolutely, having less tolerance for this kind of behavior.
The global framework of ESG, environmental, social, and governance, is emerging as an important tool for investors to monitor a company's ethical and sustainability track record. So bad practices across supply chain will affect investments. In India, the process of applying the ESG framework to assess companies is slowly picking up.
We know that renewable energy companies and those who invest in them view themselves as the good guys within the climate crisis. And for good reason, you know, we need renewable energy and it's an exciting sector and it is going to have the potential to change the world. But because of that, there has been less focus on what the adverse impacts of renewable energy projects can be and also what the expansion of mining to power these projects is. And so we feel that highlighting those risks now, while the sector is still taking shape and ensuring that they understand and have the due diligence in place, means that we set the sector up for growing success. And we mitigate as much as possible the potential for conflict. I think many investors in the renewable energy sector are making it clear that companies' human rights policies and practices are critical elements of how they evaluate material risk and financial performance of the companies. And they see having these policies and practices in place as a strategic advantage for their assets. So governments are going to play a role in holding those companies to account, but companies themselves are going to find that if they don't have these particular policies in place, if they don't have a robust human rights due diligence, that they're going to get less and less investment because it is a move that is being put forward by a lot of different investors that they want to see, you know, responsible projects. They want to see sustainable and rights respecting supply chains. They want companies to have this information on hand as well. And so industry working to bring that transparency to their own supply chains is going to be critical for them to be able to get that investment.
India took some steps to ensure a reliable supply of minerals to keep the sector running. In 2019, the government formed a company, Khanij Bidesh India Limited, or KABIL, with the participation of three central public sector enterprises. The objective of KABIL is to ensure a consistent supply of 12 critical and strategic minerals that have a meager resource base. Among those, lithium and cobalt were significant. KABIL is building partnerships with mineral-rich countries such as Australia and those in Africa and South America. When solar panels, batteries, and other types of equipment are disposed of, their mineral components also reach the end of the road. But it doesn't have to be that way. Extracting minerals from electronic waste is one of the solutions to strengthen the supply chain and prevent metals from leaching into the environment. But Jesse says that the concept of circular economy in the sector has a long way to go. A scalable, profitable technology for efficient recycling is not there yet.
I think the other reason it gets less is because it goes to challenge that extractive model, as I said, that has been profit-driven. If we need to continuously extract minerals to drive renewable energy, well, that's a massive win for the mining sector. If we're able to increase our recycling and reuse of those minerals, it means we need to extract less. And so I think there is work as a whole for governments and society and also, you know, the tech companies as well to look at, like, not just the profit of how these different pieces of technology, whether that be, you know, wind and solar, but also batteries and smartphones and laptops use these minerals, but what it means for us to be able to think about a more sustainable use of these minerals. So really putting the focus less on extraction and more on reuse and recycle. I don't think that is a conversation that has been properly discussed at a global level.
In the first episode of Gigawatt, we spoke about the lack of policy in India to treat clean tech waste and set up a recycling infrastructure. One of the experts suggested the need to improve the design of cleantech with a design to disassemble principle, making the extraction and recycling phase efficient. A startup based in Bengaluru is attempting to make a business case by extracting copper, aluminium, cobalt, nickel, and lithium from lithium-ion batteries. We spoke to its founding member, Saurav Goyal.
Metastable Materials is an urban mining company. We are starting with the lithium-ion batteries for now, where we intend to get the end-of-life batteries from, let's say, consumer electronics or from EV automobiles and get the precious metals out of them, which include lithium, your cobalt, nickel. All these metals are already in supply crunch. So what we intend to do is we intend to extract these metals out of these dead batteries and then throw them into their native supply chains so that they can be reused instead of looking forward to just the freshly mined metals out of the ores. It's kind of a free supply coming in into India. With the batteries, we are getting lithium in. With the batteries, again, we are getting the cobalt. With other electronic items also, we are getting all these metals. So it would be a huge waste of potential to just throw these batteries and e-waste into landfills or to export them for processing to some other country.
Shubham Vishwakarma founded Metastable Materials in 2021. The idea is rooted in his IIT Roorkee days when he worked to find a better recycling process for lithium-ion batteries. Now, the company claims to use a cost-effective and chemical-free method for extraction. With a new R&D center in Bengaluru, the company is yet to roll out its services on a large scale.
So here we are working on optimizing our processes, increasing the efficiency, and achieving higher purity and yield. For the next 2-3 years, what we want to do is to set up the infrastructure in the Indian context to actually treat all these lithium-ion batteries. As you know, the demand for EVs is increasing day by day, and the dead batteries are soon going to come back into the supply chain, where people need to take care of these batteries before it becomes a huge headache for the both the environmental agencies, for the government.
The renewable energy sector itself, globally and at national levels, I think is at a critical point in setting the tone for what the energy transition is going to look like. Is it going to replicate the profit-driven extractive model, which has caused significant harm? Or is it going to be the good guy? Is it going to be a new path for the energy sector that has human rights at the center? The window for that change is closing. Because like any new and growing sector, there is only a small time to influence how it's going to work. And then those practices become embedded and that just becomes the way that it is. So if we don't push for that change now, locally, nationally, globally, if we accept that, you know, a transition is going to be fast, but it's not going to be fair, then we risk, you know, all these kind of abuses that you mentioned, allowing human rights violations to flourish, replicating the abuse of the extractive sector and setting that as the model for the energy transition.
Please share this episode with your friends and family or on social media. This show was produced and scripted by my colleague, Karthik Chandramouli, edited and mixed by Tejas Dayanand Sagar, copy edits by Aditi Tandon. We got production assistance from Ayushi Kothari, and the Gigawatt artwork is by Pooja Gupta. We'll be out with another episode of Gigawatt soon. Take care.